KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dan Ronan. Pete Hegseth's nomination to lead the Department of Defense cleared a procedural vote today. NPR's Deidre Walsh reports there was some Republican opposition, but not enough expected to derail him.
Alaska Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski announced she could not support Hegseth, citing his lack of experience and reports about excessive drinking and other inappropriate behavior that raised questions about his character. A second GOP senator, Susan Collins of Maine, also plans to vote no. She raised doubt about him leading the large department and his previous comments about women serving in group combat roles. Hegseth backtracked on those, but Collins says she's not convinced his position has changed. Hegseth is not expected to get any support from Democrats, but he can afford to lose as many as 3 GOP votes. The final Senate vote is expected sometime on Friday, and Hegseth appears likely to be confirmed as Secretary of Defense, mostly along party lines. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News, the Capitol.
President Trump's nominee to lead the VA easily passed a Senate committee today. Also, NPR's Quill Lawrence reports the vast majority of the VA staff have been exempted from a federal hiring freeze.
Doug Collins, an Air Force Reserve colonel and former Georgia congressman, was endorsed by the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee 18-1, almost guaranteeing he'll be the next Secretary of Veterans Affairs. During his confirmation hearing this week, he was pressed on whether President Trump's federal hiring freeze would apply to VA. He said he needed to study it. In the meantime, doctors and nurses nationwide who thought they had VA job offers got the news their offers were rescinded. After 2 days of mixed messages, the administration has now exempted the majority of healthcare positions at VA from the hiring freeze. Senate Democrats have urged Trump to protect all VA staff positions from the freeze. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
President Trump wants Saudi Arabia to lower oil prices, which he says could bring an end to Russia's war in Ukraine. His remarks were delivered by video to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. NPR's Deborah Shrivaran has more.
After listing what he sees as accomplishments in his first week of office, Trump addressed the Economic Forum in Switzerland with a focus on tariffs, saying that if products aren't made in America, there will be tariffs added to them. He also said he would call on Saudi Arabia to bring down the cost of oil, and that doing so would, quote, immediately end the Russia-Ukraine war. Russia, which exports a lot of oil, has been relying on the high cost of it to sustain the war.
Right now, the price is high enough that that war will continue. You got to bring down the oil price. You got to end that war.
Trump also said China's Xi Jinping could help pressure Russia's Putin to end the conflict. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, The White House.
On Wall Street, all 3 major stock indexes closed the day up on Thursday. From Washington, this is NPR News. Atlanta-based cable news giant CNN is cutting 200 jobs in what leadership says is a pivot to digital operations. Melissa Fato of member station WABE reports.
CEO Mark Thompson says the move isn't to cut costs, but to make a turn further into digital operations. With most of the layoffs concentrated in the TV division, the network looks to keep a leaner staff and transfer some of its technical operations to Atlanta. Parent company Warner Brothers Discovery is investing $70 million into CNN's digital ventures. And Thompson says many of the lost jobs will eventually be replaced by new hires to support the growth in digital. Last fall, the network's website launched an online subscription plan for frequent readers, priced at $3.99 a month. CNN is also reconfiguring some of its popular programming, including moving The Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer to mornings and adding co-anchor Pamela Brown. For NPR News, I'm Melissa Fato in Atlanta.
Less than 10 months after the container ship the Dolly struck and brought down Baltimore's Key Bridge, killing six workers, the ship has been repaired and is now back in business. After tons of debris was removed from the deck of the ship, workers did temporary repairs at a shipyard in Norfolk, Virginia, and then it was taken to China for more extensive work, sea trials, validation, and now recertification. Last March, the 984-foot ship lost power and crashed into the bridge, sending the nearly 50-year-old structure into the Patapsco River. The NTSB continues its investigation of the incident. A final report, though, is still months away. From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
One of the things that make these forests magical is that the trees are so tall that everything is shaded, the area stays moist, and it stays cool.
If, like me, you grew up around trees, you love them, but you also think you know them. A tree is a tree. It has a trunk, branches, and leafy bits, or alternatively, piney bits. What else do I need to know? But tree species are wildly diverse. Some produce flowers, others thrive in salt water, and some are favored by roosting butterflies. Then there are those trees that require superlatives to describe. We'll walk among trees that can become some of the oldest in the world.
These trees grow really fast, and so even in that period, which is just over 100 years that they've been growing, they've been able to achieve these tremendous heights. And that's why when you look up, they look like they just go on and on and on. You can't even see the very tip tops.
I'm Molly Bentley, and welcome to Big Picture Science. We'll branch out in this episode, meet some trees, consider our shared future, and ask whether the best things in life are trees. Imagine a world where no plants grew higher than your waist. You could still enjoy strolling through lush grassland or a flowering meadow, but you'd never have the profound pleasure of resting in the shade of a giant.
I think one of the truisms about the coast redwood is that it's so big that it really relocates you in space in a way. And I remember walking up to one of these really giant redwoods for the very first time, and it was like being against the side of a cliff, because they're so wide that you can't really see the curvature to either side. And so it's very much like something other than a tree, I suppose. But of course, when you stand back and you see them in the distance, you really then can take in their treeness and their extraordinary size.
There are trillions of trees in the world, and they're found on every continent except Antarctica. More than a dozen different species may grace your neighborhood, but unless the wind blows, you might not notice them. It's easy to take these silent sentries for granted rather than marvel at what extraordinary examples of adaptation they are, or consider that the human relationship with trees is ancient, extending all the way back to our primate ancestors who lived in them.
Hi, I'm Daniel Lewis. I'm the Dibner Senior Curator for the History of Science and Technology at the Huntington Library, Art Museum, and Botanical Gardens in Southern California. There's nothing like working at a botanical gardens with 200 acres of gardens and grounds and trees. And I was walking through the Huntington grounds one day, and I got to thinking about In terms of trees, I mean, I think if we can understand that they need saving, for instance, and we feel a sense of urgency about them, we might see the common ground that we occupy with them.
Of the more than 73,000 species of trees in the world, Dan Lewis zeroed in on a handful for his book, 12 Trees, The Deep Roots of Our Future. And in this episode, we'll meet a few of those species, including the one that towers over them all. We begin and set this episode among redwoods because they both help us understand the plight of all trees and show us what a tree can do when it grows to extremes. Perhaps no other species has inspired as many superlatives as that which line the coasts of California and southern Oregon.
Hi, I'm Kevin Dixon. I'm a naturalist with the East Bay Regional Park District.
And where are we?
We are in Dr. Aurelia Reinhart Redwood Regional Park. The trails wind through the woods, and you're walking on a soft ground that's created by the redwood needles and twigs.
This redwood cone here on the ground, it's hard to believe that the tree grows from that tiny thing.
Well, yeah, and in fact, what it grows from is even tinier. So what we're looking at is a little redwood cone, and if you're thinking of a pine cone, this is much, much smaller, the size of the tip of my thumb, I would say. And then it's got these scales, and you can kind of look through it because this one's already opened up. And in between these scales are where it stores its seeds. And so at a certain point, the scales open up, releases the seeds, and they start out on that hopeful journey.
First and foremost, the redwood's extraordinary height is one of the most astounding things about it. And it comes up to just shy of 400 feet, the tallest known tree.
Is this the time when we should look up?
This is definitely the time to look up, yeah.
I'm going to steady myself by putting my hand on the bark of this tree and look up. Oh, my goodness.
How does that feel?
Oh, my God. It gives me a little vertigo. They're so tall.
Yeah, and one thing that kind of makes it more impressive, I think, is that as the redwood trees grow, they realize that their lower branches aren't as much use to them anymore, so they just let go of them. So you're looking all the way up into the high branches.
But what you can see is the sunlight coming through the needles or the leaves?
Well, they're both. A needle is a kind of a leaf, so they just have these small leaves, and that helps them to not lose too much water, just like pines.
Now, these trees are tall. They can grow even taller, these redwoods. They can grow to three times this height, which is unimaginable. How do they compare with the giant sequoia?
The giant sequoia is a name that people call this huge related tree, not this tree, that grows up in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And so that one is the biggest tree in the world. So it has the most volume of any tree in the world. Whereas this one, the coast redwood, is also very, very huge, not quite as big by volume, but much taller. And so one of the crazy things about California and the diversity of California is that in California, there's the tallest tree in the world, there's the biggest tree in the world, and the oldest tree in the world, all here. It's kind of crazy.
How old can a redwood get? And what is the tree that is actually older than a redwood?
So the coast redwood can clear 1,000 years in terms of age. But there's a tree that's five times older than that, the bristlecone pine, Pinus longaeva. Its longevity is actually baked into its scientific name. And it grows at high altitude in a band of land in the American West and Southwest. And you'd never guess their age from their size because they're gnarled survivors. They're twisted, they're stunted, and sometimes in some cases they're bent so far over from the winds that they're horizontal to the ground, and they only get to 20 or 30 feet at the very tallest. They're, you know, five, the oldest one is just cleared 5,000 years old.
Do we understand how these Methuselah trees, the redwoods and the bristlecone pine, what the secret is to their longevity?
You know, this is perhaps a theory of mine. I think that the fact that they're subjected to stresses is what helps them survive. Because when any organism is subjected to some kind of a stress, it has to figure out how to evolve to manage that stress. And so there are very selective pressures. And the fact that it's really windy up there and cold and that the soil is poor seems to push the bristlecone pine to survive and to keep surviving. And so I think it's perhaps something about the fact that these pressures really, for lack perhaps of a better term, keep it busy. And I think the same is probably true to a degree for the coast redwood. They also tend to grow in groves, and as a result, they're clustered together in a way that protects them from the wind, or at least sort of distributes the wind more evenly across a group of trees. And I think that helps them a lot, because if they were solo trees all alone, I think you'd find that they would fall over much more readily. And of course, they do fall over. And if you're up in a redwood forest, one of the things you're struck by is that a number of them are sort of leaning collegially against other redwoods.
So this tree looks like it's fallen or it's leaning?
It is leaning. Wow, look at this. The way it's leaning right across the trail, so we have to walk under it. It's kind of at a 45-degree angle, and it's leaning on some other trees on the other side of the trail. So it's partially uprooted, but it certainly has not given up. So what it has decided to do is regrow branches from the base of its trunk. So we're walking under
the
tree.
So these branches are actually growing from the trunk.
Exactly, but they're growing lower down, which you don't see on any of the other trees. So it's reorienting itself.
To the sun?
Yes. So it's a little more clever than you might expect. A lot of its roots are out of the ground. Some of them are still in the ground. And it's leaning across the trail into a clump of redwood trees on the other side. And branches are coming all out of the trunk. So it's fun. You're walking under a green arch as you come through here.
And do you think those trees over there that are helping support it mind doing that?
No. And if you look around you, you'll see clusters of trees, and each tree has a reddish, brownish, soft, furrowed bark. And if you go closer to them and get a better view, you can touch the bark and feel it, and you feel it's kind of soft. And this bark will protect the trees when a fire comes through.
I mean, this feels like substantial bark.
So redwoods have evolved exceptional fire resilience. Their bark is very thick. And so this probably became more and more pronounced over time, over the centuries and the millennia, in fact, over tens of thousands of years or hundreds of thousands of years, as the fire regimes in their ranges, you know, fluctuated, especially during drier periods. And, you know, for instance, redwoods really rely heavily on coastal fog.
Kevin, in what ways is the story of the redwood the story of water?
So it gets very hot and dry in California during the summer. It pulls moisture in from the ocean, and especially at night and in the early morning, that comes in the form of fog. And so these redwoods need a lot of water because they have to get the water all the way up to their leaves there, high in the trees. It can condense on the leaves of the redwoods, and they're expert at condensing the water on their leaves. And then once it gets to a certain size, it makes a drop, and that will drop down to where their roots can get it. So they make their own rain from the fog.
So does that mean that a redwood is collecting water from the top, from the sky, and also from the ground?
Yeah, that's correct. And one really interesting thing about how this works, how they collect water from the leaves, is I think it's still not fully understood, but it appears that they have a fungal partner that actually lives inside the tree, is not damaging the tree in any way, but is helping them to collect that water through the leaves.
I think we could all point out a tree. We know one when we see one. I don't know if we all know what the definition of a tree is. So Dan, what is a tree, and what makes a tree and not a shrub?
That's such a great question. You might be shocked to hear this, but there is no really solid definition of a tree. And I was told this by Jim Folsom, who was the director of the Botanical Gardens at the Huntington a few years ago when I started in on this work. There are some characteristics, okay? And so trees are typically taller than, say, shrubs. They have stems. Trees are usually characterized by a single dominant woody stem or a trunk. And then they typically have a crown of some kind, you know, a distinct canopy or a crown, and the branches start higher up from the trunk, whereas shrubs are a little more compact and a little more dense. And then they serve different ecological functions. You know, trees often form the dominant layer of a forest canopy, so they give shade and habitat for lots of things, and shrubs typically are in the understory in a forest. So there's a fuzzy boundary, but you know, I think I think this is perhaps not very satisfying, but you know a tree when you see one. I think it's safe to say.
Here we are. We're standing and looking at the bark of these trees. If I look behind this tree that's in front of me, the one that I'm touching right now, I see there's a ring of trees with a hollow space in the middle. And if you look up in the ring, it's just a beautiful view of the blue sky just high above you. And the reason this hollow is there is because there was once a tree present in the hollow at the center of this ring. And we can even see remnants of the original stump. This was cut down to build San Francisco and all the housing here in the San Francisco Bay Area right after the Gold Rush. And then again, after the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. So what we're looking at here are actually the third generation of redwoods. And what is miraculous about that is that if you can imagine when this area was cut all the way down to the ground, all the vegetation was seared by the sun. And if you had looked at it then, you would have thought there was no hope of regeneration. But redwoods are tremendously strong, and they have a root system which links them all together. So after they cut these trees down to the short stumps, those roots supplied the young saplings that grew from the old stumps, and they were able to regenerate and create the redwood forest that we see now.
So the ring of trees around this hollow area are those saplings, or they were those saplings. And did the mother tree drop the cones that made these saplings? Is that why there's a ring around the what used to be the tree?
No, in one sense, these trees are the mother tree. Because
I'm sorry, they are the mother tree?
Yes, they are the mother tree, because when that stump was cut down, there are buds around the base of that mother tree, and they're nourished by that root network that I talked about. And then those little shoots, like you can see here, that are around the base of these trees now, they grew up to become these big trees that we're leaning against right now.
Does that mean that all new trees are the continuation of the old tree?
That is true in this park, almost all of them. Occasionally they do come up from seed, but that's a pretty rare occurrence here.
Biologists love to climb trees, and you have to have an affinity for being at high altitude to climb a tree. And so some botanists have an affinity for climbing trees, and those that are willing to do so have encountered extraordinary things up high in the canopy. So they've discovered new species of earthworms. They've discovered grass growing up on high. They've discovered trees growing within. There's a Sitka spruce that was discovered growing up 10 feet tall up in the canopy of the redwood. There's a species of salamander called the wandering salamander that spends almost all of its life up in the canopy. Not only does it live up there, but if it's disturbed and it needs to get away from something, it jumps out of the tree. And the shape of their body is just such that it creates enough drag that they don't die when they land. It takes them a couple minutes to fall from the top of the tallest trees. That's a long time to be airborne, it strikes me.
What do you think about that, Dan? Do you think you would like to live your life up in a redwood and then when it was time to leave, just parachute gently down to the floor?
There would be advantages to living up high in a tree. You're certainly safe from the rest of the world until someone decides to cut you down. Then you've got a sort of an existential difficulty.
And certainly the coast redwood, which used to dominate the West Coast, or grew much more widely, at least those primordial growth, the old growth, are limited to just a few small areas now.
Well, one of the things I'll say that's great is the trees really are very well protected now, which is not the case for many other important species of trees. They're mostly on national parkland. They're well cared for. They're watched. There's a whole coterie of botanists that tend to them in the sense that they make sure that they're safe.
Well, Kevin, we'd like to turn to you now as someone who spends a lot of time with trees, and particularly redwood trees. When Dan says that trees can live up to 1,000 years, the bristlecone pine, 5,000 years. Do you ever reflect, Kevin, on the fact that generations of people have been looking at some of these same trees?
I absolutely do. It's something that I often reflect on. And
hundreds of generations, not just since the gold rush and since this place became part of the United States, but hundreds of generations of people have lived here and appreciated these trees and honored them.
And the other big question, have you ever had a wandering salamander drop on your head?
No, that's something that I look forward to. And then I would enjoy watching it start its climb back up the trunk.
How long do you think it takes to get back to the top of the tree?
Oh my gosh, from what I've seen, they're pretty slow. A week? I don't know.
Coming up, how trees first emerged and the swamp species that is helping protect Louisiana wetlands, as we continue making the case that the best things in life are trees. I'm Big Picture Science. Remarkable companions. They provide us with timber and shade, sequester carbon and release oxygen, and serve as homes to countless organisms. One such organism was us. Our primate ancestors stopped swinging from trees and started walking on the ground nearly 4 million years ago. Well, we may have left our forest habitats, but we haven't stopped walking among trees. We continue our Redwood Forest Walk with naturalist Kevin Dixon. We've been talking about redwoods, but what are some of the companion trees in this area?
So some of the trees that would be right around us here, maple growing right here along the creek, alders which grow with their toes in the water, oaks which cover the hillsides, and bay trees are all over the place too. So the bay trees are these really fragrant trees. And another name for the bay tree is the pepperwood because they have a spicy leaves. I do encourage people to hug the trees and even to put their cheek up against the tree. It gives you a different sensation of what it's like to be in the forest, because the forest is a very, very quiet place, especially the redwood. You notice a particular kind of quiet when you're in a redwood forest. So you kind of stop, you take in that quiet, and you come up to a redwood tree, you touch it, and if you want to get to know it even more intimately, I know it sounds a little silly, but it's something that I actually do with people when I go out on walks. You put your cheek up against the tree, you lean against it, and you wrap your arms around it. And you can still do that with these trees because they're not quite giants yet.
Okay, I'm going to do that. So I'm going to wrap my arms around the tree, put my cheek against it. It's so solid. It's so steady. It's actually quite calming.
It is, yes. Yeah.
I've heard you say in other conversations that you're a tree person, and my fellow tree people. What are tree people? And can you be a tree person and a people person?
Oh, that is such a good question, Molly. Sometimes you feel like you're more of a tree person, and sometimes you feel like you're more of a people person, I think is the way it goes. And so lately, I think I've been more focused on trees, which doesn't mean that I'm ignoring people entirely.
Trees emerged on Earth long before humans did, of course.
Their key adaptations, roots, wood, and leaves, allowed them to access more sunlight and water. Environmental historian Dan Lewis describes the earliest appearance of trees.
Yeah, so trees are old, and they really evolved from really early land plants during the Devonian period, which was, if you remember your high school or college geology or botany, was about 400 million years ago. And the very first tree-like plants were probably ferns with woody tissue, and they started developing these vascular systems for moving water and nutrients around through this vascular tissue. They started developing actual leaves, and leaves are really an essential component for trees because you need a big surface area for photosynthesis. And then seeds come along not much later, say 100 million years later, and then flowers come along, and then they start to really diversify. And they really start changing ecosystems as a result of that. They start oxygenating the atmosphere. The planet used to be a much lower percentage of oxygen than it has now. They started to store carbon, which led to climate regulation and the formation of coal deposits, soil development, and so on. So they really reshaped Earth's climate and the atmosphere and their landscapes, which suddenly made them central to life as we know it. Even before humans came along, they really were an essential part of the environment.
You know, reading your book, I found myself wondering what the world looked like before humans started cutting trees down. And do we have any sense what it would have been like to walk around when trees were not being cut down in the numbers they are by humans? What would the world have been like?
I think it would be shocking to people because, first of all, the amount of stands of forest, old growth forest, really old trees that have gone through had long lives, dominated the continents to greater or lesser degrees. And in North America, you know, they stretch for millions and millions of acres. And you wouldn't know it from the ground, but if somehow in a magical way you could lift yourself up in a balloon 5,000 years ago, you would be gobsmacked to see how much the forest extent constituted. It just spread for thousands of miles in some directions, and because there was no reason for that not to be the case. You know, they were the dominant species. The other thing I'll say about forests early on in the human experience is, for a lot of people, they were terrifying, big forests, because they were not the romantic places we think of forests now. They were dark, full of unknowns, full of terrifying, dangerous things. So, you know, settlers in North America land, and there are these forests, and they quickly start cutting them down to make use of them. But there are accounts of people that talk about how terrifying it was to be out in the middle of these dark forests by themselves.
There are many tree species, more than 70,000, I think, and each one has its own way, its own strategy for staying alive and thriving. And while all trees need water, the bald cypress tree thrives with part of its trunk and roots in water. Now, this is the state tree of Louisiana, and if anyone's seen one, you know that they can be quite haunting to look at, standing there in the water, draped with Spanish moss. I wonder if you could describe for us how the bald cypress is able to survive partly submerged.
It's a remarkable adaptation. It's got these buttressed roots, and it's been an open question for a couple hundred years as to exactly how they stay afloat. And the buttress roots sort of taper down into the water, and it gives it a very solid base.
Dan, are the buttress roots the same as the knees, what are we called the knees of the cypress?
Completely different thing, would you believe? So let me just say, the tree's adapted to have these unusually long root systems that really help to anchor the tree in this really muddy, saturated soil. But the knees are something completely different. They're these stilt-like projections that rise maybe a foot or more above the waterline, and they're kind of placed around the tree. And people thought for a long time that these knees were sort of an aide-de-camp to the roots, that they carried oxygen down into the water, like a kind of a root snorkel, perhaps. But then these studies have shown that there's no oxygen or carbon dioxide exchange between the roots and the knees. And so we don't really know why these knees are there. Even though they're relatively easy to get to and they're relatively easy to test, we just don't really understand at all.
I'm interested to hear you say they're easy to get to, and I think you mean once you put on your waders or step into your kayak and go into the swamp, because that's where the bald cypress lives in that brackish water, that mixture of fresh and salt water deep in the Louisiana swamps, not just Louisiana, but...
I was going to say easy to get to as a relative term, and I was thinking of, you know, if you have to climb 300 feet up into the canopy of a coast redwood, I find that would be harder than getting in a kayak and paddling happily to a bald cypress, relatively speaking.
Yeah, keep your eye out for the water snakes and the alligators. There's a striking illustration of how the bald cypress can hold up, how sturdy they are. Could you describe the underwater forest that scientists found in the last dozen years or so off the coast of Alabama in the Gulf waters?
Yeah, it's extraordinary. So divers came upon this bald cypress forest that was more than 70,000 years old, as it turns out, about 60 feet underwater, and it was actually several miles off the coast of Alabama in the Gulf of Mexico. And the trees, of course, were dead, but they were still standing in place. They were arranged as a forest. Some of the trees were still upright. Some laid flat where they had fallen, probably before they were overcome by the ocean. And, you know, it had probably been uncovered by Hurricane Katrina in 2005, and it promptly became an artificial reef. So there are all sorts of species, and it was swarming with life. And these logs for these trees were huge. And some of the stumps were 6 feet in diameter, and they were probably thousands of years old before they died. And one of the things I found most astounding is when they brought some to the surface and they cut them, they released this sap odor and this odor of fresh cypress. So, you know, they carry this whole cargo of organic content, and those samples are super useful. And you can actually do dendrochronological analysis on those trees because they're dead, they can be cut, and you can then study the trees and their tree rings to see what climatic conditions were like 70,000 years ago. So super important, super useful for being able to understand environmental conditions quite a long time ago through these tree rings.
The bald cypress is also holding together Louisiana wetlands because those roots are holding together that precious sediment which forms the land, which is eroding. And the cypress is threatened because of logging, because of the disappearance of the wetlands. And in Louisiana, the swamps are becoming more salty because the levees are cutting off fresh water from the Mississippi. That is a whole story of many, many things happening there on the Gulf Coast. What is the plan for saving these trees? Or maybe we should start with, what is the fate of the bald cypress? And is there a plan for saving these trees?
I think it's probably, first of all, I'll say it's to their benefit that they are not on dry land, because it does make it more difficult to log and harvest trees in swamplands and, you know, areas that are saturated with water. There are some particular things that tend to be difficult for the bald cypress. One of the things that's happening as sea level rise increases around the world because of climate change, higher concentrations of salt water come up to the habitat of the trees. And so it's a really kind of a natural, unnatural threat, in that it's natural and that it's salt water, it's unnatural, and that climate change, human-caused climate change, has led to these difficulties.
I just want to clarify one thing here, because we're talking about these waters becoming more saline, but we did say earlier that these are brackish waters, so the bald cypress can live in salty water if the ratios are right. The problem is that it's becoming too salty.
That's exactly right. There's too much salt. And as the case with so many things, a little is okay, but a lot is too much. So as soon as the salt content starts rising, the tree starts doing poorly, and it kills the trees once it gets too salty. And so, of course, as sea levels rise, more ocean water infiltrates these harbors and areas where the trees are located. And so one very recent and promising approach has been to inoculate the trees to improve their saline resilience by using what are called salt-tolerant endophytes, which are fungi and bacteria that they can then essentially inject into the trees. And, you know, the hope is that these endophytes will take up long-term residence in root systems. They've got other strategies. They've tried putting salicylic acid in the water, which, you know, benefits the tree in a number of different ways. It increases the quantity of chlorophyll and other kind of subtle signs of beneficial growth. So it's a very active area of research about really how to bolster the tree's defense mechanisms. You know, there are different kinds of proteins that transport water across cell membranes and so on. There are all sorts of aspects to, you know, it's not really what I would call genetic modification as much as it is we're introducing factors that are kind of helpmates to the tree's survival.
Kind of like a genetic assist.
Yeah, that's a good term, a genetic assist, you know, something that helps the tree's mechanisms work more effectively.
Well, would we be forgiven if we were both grateful to the scientists finding ways to save these trees by perhaps introducing other organisms or something else you talk in the book is through genetic engineering or selective breeding, and also feel very uneasy by some of these approaches? I mean, humans have gotten trees into this mess because of our reliance on them, because we have changed the environment. And can we engineer and tinker our way out of this mess? Shouldn't we have some hesitancy about that?
I think humans have genetically, if you think about it as genetic modification, have modified plants genetically for hundreds and hundreds of years. So if you think about grafting a rose or modifying a plant to create some kind of genetic adaptation so that they do better in warmer and drier climates. And I think we've already pressed our hand so firmly on the scale of the natural world that I think we're going to have to continue to do things that are active interventions to the planet to be able to help the planet survive. And clearly we've screwed things up, and I think it now is going to fall to us to fix them, and a lot of those fixes are going to involve manipulations that in a kinder, gentler, purer world we might be reluctant to do, but I think they really have become kind of essential quests, because I think trying to do something armed with the right information and done carefully is more important than letting things lie, because letting them be as they are really not enough.
Kevin, any thoughts about this discussion, including that of the bald cypress?
Well, it got me thinking about evolution, because when I learned about redwoods and I learned about bald cypresses, I learned that they were in the same family. And since then, botanists have decided to split them up. And so they're no longer in the same family, but they're still in the cypress family.
Redwoods are in the cypress family?
Yes, they are now. They are now. They didn't used to be. But one thing that stood out is that both of these trees face threats. When we're talking about the giant sequoia in the Sierra Nevada, for example, climate change is presenting a problem. And with that, the occurrence of more severe fires along with the drought. And when you're talking about the bald cypresses, threatened by the incursion of salt water, which makes their environment unlivable. So as Dan says, if we want to preserve these treasures that we've inherited, we need to actively care for these trees, as the future of our future and the future of these trees is tied together.
Coming up, what's next for trees? How their futures are intertwined with ours, as we consider why the best things in life are trees on Big Picture Science.
Thank you.
walk through a forest, redwood or deciduous, we might reflect on the many ways we depend on trees. They keep us cool in their shade and release the oxygen that keeps us alive. But look around your home. It's probably made of and filled with the products of trees, from the house's wooden frame to its floorboards and doors, tables, chairs, books, and bookcases themselves. The paper in the printer and the toilet roll is obvious, but rummage through a kitchen drawer, also likely made of wood, you might find toothpicks and wooden spoons, chopsticks, maybe a wine cork, and let's not forget about that bowl of fruit, but maybe now we're mixing apples and oranges.
We are coming to the intersection of some trails here. We've been walking on the stream trail, and now we're coming to the mill trail. So this whole canyon where we are now, this deeply shaded canyon, was full of mills churning out lumber. Mm. I think maybe this is where the old mill was, right around here. There's some concrete on the trail, so yeah.
So there would have been a lumber mill here?
Yes.
So those would have been the mills that churned out the lumber that built San Francisco twice, once before the earthquake and once after.
That's right.
Logging has so reduced the number of redwoods in California, for example, that only 4% of the old-growth forest remains. And while all tree species have long had to adapt to climate change, those shifts in our climate are now happening faster, which raises questions about their ability to keep up. But we have shaken up tree habitats in other ways. Consider the shaggy-barked and fragrant blue gum eucalyptus, for example, one of the trees that environmental historian Daniel Lewis profiles in his book, 12 Trees. Some of its seeds were sent to California by boat from Australia in the 1850s. Unlike its cousin, the hardy, fire-resistant redwood, eucalyptus wood splits easily, making it a poor choice for woodworking, and it is flammable. It became known as an invasive pest among humans, while it also became the preferred roosting spot for monarch butterflies. We've been talking about human-tree interconnection, and Dr. Lewis reflects on the blame that the eucalyptus has received for breaking down the interconnectedness of the California ecosystem.
You know, I have lots of things to say about so-called invasive species, which I prefer to call introduced species. You know, there's a great quote by Mark Twain about this. He said, "Nature knows no indecencies, man invents them." And it really strikes me that people tend to use really militarized and villainizing language when they're describing, you know, other so-called invasive species. You hear it everywhere. My take on this is that, you know, these critters have shown up in these new homes. It's not because of their own agency, but it's really through careless, you know, handling by humans. And these plants and animals are doing what they do. They're blamed for doing what all organisms do, which is to try to reproduce and survive. I think that's really important to understand. The blue gum has been implicated in fires. People don't like its messy ways. There are a lot of things people find unattractive about it. But, you know, we planted them there. They didn't plant themselves there.
Why was the blue gum eucalyptus brought to California?
I think so. I mean, I think, landscaping has always been of interest. And I think, you know, they were exotic. And I think people really ransacked the planet in a way for exotic trees that they could use to beautify their homes. And so I think that was a key aspect to it. You know, we have a lot of beautiful trees here, but the blue gum, you know, is different because it's from Australia. It looks different. It smells different. It also serves as a great windbreak. And it serves a really important role in the survival of migratory butterflies and other natives. And so it's really become an integral part of the landscape of California. And some species of plants and animals have actually gone through enough evolutionary processes that they're actually unique to a region. And I'll give you a non-tree example. The minor bird, Aquitotherius tristus tristus, was imported to Hawaii 150 years ago. And it has now evolved into something genetically distinct, and that's how evolution works. And so how do we think of something that is now unique to Hawaii? Is that a native species? Most people would call it a pest from the mainland. So these trees that arrive in places from other places and then start to change really confound our understanding of what it means to say something as a native or not. And I think it's probably true that the blue gum has experienced localized pressures that have changed it. Everything is in the process of turning into something else. And I think the blue gum is an example of something that has now become somewhat more adapted to the climate here in California and the American West that makes it a native.
Well, Dan, humans have long admired the beauty of trees, but they have also been seen, of course, as a straight commodity. They've been harvested to make timber, paper, rubber, fuel. Humans are always going to exploit trees, I think. But is there a way that we can take advantage of them without driving them to extinction?
I think there's a middle ground that offers us ways to take advantage of trees. And some of them are perhaps obvious. You know, city street trees, for instance, if you plant them, they do things like they lower the surface temperature of concrete areas. They, you know, provide shade. And so I think there are ways to think about trees as fellow residents within our byways, and I think, you know, that is a way to make use of them and their gifts without having to cut them down, tear them down, pluck things off of them, or otherwise, you know, disrupt their lives. And so really more trees is probably one panacea, and one way to think about the ways that trees could help us is to really increase their presence everywhere, and carefully and strategically, because, you know, trees also are messy. They have root systems that can be disruptive, and so if you're sort of conscious of those things, you can get them in the right places. And, you know, that seems like a simple solution, but I think it might be a very good one for the long haul, is that, you know, if we can increase the density of trees on the planet, we'll be doing everybody a favor.
You say that more trees is better. I wonder, this raises the question of whether tree planting programs work. They certainly seem that there'd be no harm to them, that they must be positive, but it's true that sometimes these tree planting programs can be disruptive to ecosystems. Sometimes they deplete local water sources. Do you have any thoughts about tree planting programs?
So, for instance, like in 2019, in a burst of, you know, civic pride and environmental duty, Ethiopia planted 350 million seedlings in a single day, which I find astonishing. They closed schools and government offices so that everybody could join the planting work. As it turns out, though, many to most of those seedlings died. So it's not really about quantity, it's about careful quality. And I think it's also true that trees don't really do much work for us until they get bigger. So it takes them a while to get big enough to sequester carbon. Obviously, it takes them a while to get tall enough to provide shade, you know, and so I think that is a really important factor, is, again, the time factor. They've got to have enough time to do their thing, and, you know, as they say, the best tree to plant is a tree you planted 20 years ago.
As you said, many trees have been successful vehicles of adaptation or organisms of adaptation, and they've been successful in adapting to changing climates throughout evolutionary history, but of course human-driven climate change is coming in faster than some animal and plant species can adapt. Dan, how are trees faring in our current warming world?
You know, it's hard to generalize because scientists tend to study things in parts and rather than in a global sense, because it requires so many resources to get a fix on, say, the health of all of a particular species of trees in a large region, because it requires a lot of close study. But what is true, I think, is that they've done, for the examples where they've tried to study survivability of trees in different locations, they've done quite well in some instances. They found that the coast redwood is doing better in warmer, drier climates than they had expected, for instance. They've discovered that, to go back to the bald cypress again, they understand that the bald cypress is very flexible in its behaviors. Same for the longleaf pine, one of the tree species in the book. It's shown its adaptability in lots of different kind of circumstances. And so trees are incredibly flexible and tolerant. They're not fussy organisms. Their long evolution has given them purchase of a kind that really helps them continue to survive. And so that's one of the things that gives trees a leg up. To mix my metaphors, the fact that they have survived for a long time means that they're well suited to continue to survive. And the fact that there are many different species of trees says something about the fact that they're genetically diverse, that they're still numerous. I mean, I think that even though the decline of trees in the last 300, 200, 300 years is disheartening, the fact that they continue to thrive in a lot of settings and that they're really well protected by humans in a lot of settings, and, you know, there are a lot of people who want to help trees, as a really heartening thing.
As you described, trees are repositories of history, if only because many outlive us and they predated the human arrival on this planet. Some produce amber that captures plants and insects and provides us with a record of past ecosystems. Your final chapter is a musing of deep history and record keeping. When it comes to trees and humans and tree-human partnerships, what was the message you wanted to impart here?
So to me, trees really are a form of evidence, right? They have rings that you can count. They have qualities that you can measure. They breathe, they respire, they have respiration. They, you know, provide us with all sorts of evidence about the natural world through their unique lens, as it were, through their unique gifts. And I really want people to understand that there are material parts of trees that we can think of as a form of remembrance and recollection. So you can't understand trees without seeing their physical attributes, without understanding how they grow, without understanding how much like a book they are. They're something that we can make sense of through the physicality of trees. And so this whole issue of recording is a really an essential one, because without this recording of trees and their attributes and their qualities and their changes, you know, we need that information to continue to understand how to save them.
And when you describe them as record keepers that shed some light on ecosystems, that is through deep time, decades ago, centuries ago, in the case of some of the trees we talked about, the redwood and the bristlecone pine, thousands of years ago.
It's so important. And, you know, as Shakespeare said, what's past is prologue. You know, all of this deep evidence from deep time that trees record becomes really useful to understanding what the future holds. So to try to predict the future patterns of climate change really relies essentially on information that we've recorded from the deep lives of these trees. How have they responded in the past to climate events, and how are they responding now? And so thus we can extrapolate, you know, how they might respond in the future, which becomes really important information to keeping them alive and well.
Dan Lewis, thank you so much for coming into the studio today to talk to us about trees. It was really a pleasure.
Molly, the pleasure's been mine.
Dan Lewis is an environmental historian and senior curator for the History of Science and Technology at the Huntington Library, Art Museum, and Botanical Gardens in Southern California. He also teaches about the natural sciences and the environment at Caltech, and he is the author of 12 Trees, The Deep Roots of Our Future. Well, this brings us to the big picture. Kevin, what are some of the big themes emerging?
I think it's amazing to look around and realize that these trees were cut down to nothing, and that they have regenerated, and now we're sitting in this redwood forest again.
And the help that they got in this case was this area is now protected.
That is true, and this place where we are now, the Reinhardt Redwood Park, is one of the best places to understand that, because it was really the actions of the community members and some really committed people that makes it what it is today, so that they weren't harvested a third and a fourth time and disappear completely. And here's a place that people now cherish. So we've supported these trees, and they're giving back to us.
Well, Kevin Dixon, thank you so much for joining us on what is a rare treat for me, a walk through a redwood forest, but perhaps all in a day's work for you. This has been lovely. Thank you.
Oh, it's really good to be out with you, Molly.
Kevin Dixon is a naturalist with the East Bay Regional Park District. If we sit here for a moment and we're just quiet, really all you hear are a few birds and then the wind moving through the trees.
Yeah, it's you can hear maybe a little bit of the stream in the distance.
This show is rooted in the teamwork provided by astronomer and producer Seth Shostak, senior producer Gary Niederhoff, and assistant producer Shannon Rose Geary and Brian Edwards. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley, and we all give a big thanks to our listeners and our patrons.
We're going to cut in really quick to let you know that we're going live in just a few moments up to the Bristol Bay Sockeye Tournament, where our very own Mia Cromer will be giving us a live play-by-play as well as the live video stream. If you want to go to the Sandpoint Sports Network, you'll see Mia live right now. Well, you won't see her. You'll see the basketball game. The rookies are going up against their next opponent. Not certain who they're playing, but
funding
they're going to go
KSDP is made
tonight,
possible in part by the King
today.
Cove Corporation.
Hopefully they
win. Operating
the
fleet.
She'll be live with the play-by-play
hotel,
and go to
the
Heart
Lakes Apartments and the last
on Facebook
tavern.
If you'd like to see
the King
video
Cove Corporation
as well.
Is a proud sponsor
Stick around.
Of KSDP.
We'll be live in just a few minutes. Rookies coming up on KSDP.